Good afternoon, Jordana Green here. The time now is 12:20 on Wednesday, May 31st, and welcome to Playing Politics, a political podcast in partnership with WCCO Radio and the Star Tribune's editorial board. Joining me in studio is John Rash, columnist at the Star Tribune's editorial board, and Patricia Lopez, an editorial writer for the Strib as well. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Always so much to discuss, and we had to make sure we say the time, because from here till 10 minutes from now, things
anything
are changing.
Could change.
You know, there's no such thing as a slow news day. There's hardly a slow news hour, nowadays.
Certain politics is always the hot topic. Let's start with Governor Dayton's budget. Mm. We know last night at 5:30, it was breaking news, and what I talked about on my show last night, and I'd like your comments on, is his defunding of the state legislature. Is this really going to happen, or is it a game of chicken? Patricia, we'll start with you.
Well, it's both, really. I mean, you know, it is definitely a game of chicken. The legislature, you could say, probably started it by inserting their own defunding proposal in the tax bill, which is that unless the governor signed the tax bill, there would be no funding for the Department of Revenue, which, of course, collects and processes the funds for all of the other agencies of state government. So they presented him with, you know, an either or. He at first was going to let the tax bill become signature without law. They quickly shifted on that. He signed the bill into law, but
he
then
did.
Said he would line item veto most of, not all of, the funding for the legislative branch. I think they made a provision that would allow some of the nonpartisan staff to continue.
I hope so. I was worried about that.
Yeah, but you know, still, I mean, defunding most of the legislative branch is no small thing. So, you know, so you've got both sides at war with each other. They're probably going to head to court. You know, where the court will have to give some guidance because we're kind of in uncharted water. Now, the governor's office has told me that they did consult with an attorney, so they feel they're on fairly firm legal ground with this. He does have the authority to line item appropriations, and it doesn't say except for the legislative branch. On the other hand, this has not been tried before. I don't think we can really be sure of where the courts would come down on this. So the end result may well be the special session that everybody was hoping to avoid.
You know, Jordana, you asked about if it's a game of chicken with each other. It's also a game of chicken with Minnesotans and with voters. And so many of them are looking east to Washington and seeing extraordinary dysfunction, regardless of where they fall on the political spectrum. And so often look to home to have what usually works relatively well, which is state government out of the legislature in St. Paul. And to see this happen, particularly when there appeared to be an agreement after having to go into a special session already, I think threatens to deepen the cynicism of voters. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's very volatile for both parties as they head into the 2018 election cycle.
It certainly has legs. And before I let this one go, I just want to define defunding the legislature. Are we talking about just not paying salaries of the legislators?
I think it's $32 million apiece for the House and the Senate, which is the money that's used to pay the legislators themselves and the operations of the of the legislative branch. So what I'm not clear on right now is the distinction between nonpartisan staff, which is a small part, you know, but then you have, you know, each the House and the Senate, Democrats and Republicans employ their own partisan staffs. Mm-hmm. Each legislator has a staff, the committees have staffs, they have their own budget people. So all of that is kind of at risk at this point. They don't have much. They have a little bit of reserve. It's really more like cash flow money that could keep them going for a few weeks, but then it starts to shut down.
Let's go to national politics now. Just today, we're finding out that President Trump is going to pull out of the Paris Accord. What ramifications will this have for us and for Minnesotans?
Right. Well, first of all, I should note he has not officially said that himself. He is teasing it out, as has been his practice. And there are stories that are quoting White House sources anonymously that say that this is his intention.
I think all the White House sources are anonymous these days.
Yes. And you know what? That's no different from any other administration. So let's just set that to rest right there. This is not the first one to quote anonymous sources in a story. And he has hinted that there may be language modifications. I think what we don't know yet is he going to try to do something like with NATO, where he at first signaled he was going to pull out completely and then said, no, that would be too disruptive. I'm going to go back in and try to renegotiate it. Mm-hmm. I think that's a more difficult proposition with an accord that every other country except for Syria and Nicaragua has signed off on. The U.S., I'm not sure we may still be in a position to dictate a change of terms. They've all gone through a lot of work to get to this accord as it stands. And the EU, all of the European Union, and China today reaffirmed their commitment to that language as it exists today. If the United States reopens it, then everything falls apart, you know, because then other countries are going to have the changes they want to make.
Sure.
And then you're back to square one. They may just try to proceed without us.
You know, there's certainly environmental implications that Patricia well explains here, and diplomatic ones as well. As she just mentioned, there are two nations that are not party to it, and they are hardly party to the overall issue in terms of the amount of emissions coming out of Nicaragua and Syria are minuscule compared to the global total, and in particular the percent that the U.S. accounts for. So the impact from an environmental perspective could be extraordinary in terms of them not being part of it, and it has significant diplomatic implications, which is why reportedly Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is urging President Trump to stay in it, because trying to abrogate a treaty of this magnitude can have after effects. And Patricia just noted NATO nations and some of the challenges that came out of President Trump's trip last week. And already he is at odds with the European Union, NATO, in particular, Chancellor Merkel out of Germany. And, you know, moving from here, which is reportedly what the leaders of the G7 industrialized countries were really pressing President Trump to do, which is to stay in the Paris Climate Accord, would be yet further rupturing of longstanding diplomatic protocols. So I think the impact would be very significant in nearly every aspect of the presidency.
Jordana, here's my larger concern about all of this that I've been thinking about for some time now. I understand, you know, Republicans are, you know, some of them are leery of the whole climate change idea in general. There are some that are really bothered by the fact that this is a treaty, quote unquote, that never came to Congress for ratification. You know, so there are issues there. But this idea of, you know, the rest of the world basically getting together and saying we're going to proceed is something that, you know, just a little bit more isolates the United States, diminishes our standing as a superpower and our claim to leadership in this world. And this is something we may see happening on several fronts. If we, you know, as these other nations, Germany last week, as a result of the president's trip, said, you know, we can't count on the U.S. as a reliable partner anymore. We have to go our own way. To the extent that other nations make, you know, reach that same conclusion, you know, on the one hand, you could say, fine, well, we're not footing the bill for NATO anymore, but it all diminishes our standing as a superpower, our moral authority to lead the world. And that can have some serious security implications for this country that I'm very concerned about.
You know, Patricia makes some great points in terms of our international standing and our transnational relations. But to take the conversation full circle, I think that many who advocate for what the Paris Accord was trying to do will look toward state legislatures as well as governors across the country, who in effect will say, whatever the U.S. decides to do regarding the Paris Agreement, we're going to keep some stricter environmental standards in play, and in particular California. And with the population of nearly 40 million and the market force that it represents, you may and probably will get a lot of businesses who say, we're still going to proceed as if the United States is still a party to this, because if we can't sell our product, think of the automotive industry. If they have to deal with
the rest of the world.
Absolutely. And these are, it's a global marketplace. So that may be one thing that might mitigate the impact of the U.S. pulling out. But as Patricia so well described, it also can lower the standing of the United States
right.
in the world.
Right. Doesn't help the relationship.
No.
No. And even within the United States, does it help us to have, you know, various states and multinational corporations deciding, well, you know, the Trump administration may have pulled out of the Paris Accord, but we're going to go ahead and observe, the dictates of the treaty, because we want to be able to operate outside the United States.
Isn't this also a way for him to fulfill a campaign promise? He talked about bringing coal back and relaxing some regulations for energy and oil companies. I mean, he's doing what he said he was going to do.
Indeed he is, and elections have consequences, and this is not something that was not well telegraphed during the campaign. He, you know, famously has called climate change a hoax perpetrated, you know, by the Chinese, in order to get an economic advantage, you know, from this perspective. And yet, when you look at the specific coal issue, market forces, again, are much more important than political ones in this. I think that, in perhaps the best metaphor for what's happening, the coal mining museum in West Virginia, quite famously a few months ago, decided to put solar panels on its roof in order to provide the energy for the building. And it talks about alternative energy sources, and more than anything, the fracking revolution focused so much here in the United States has changed the energy picture so dramatically, and cleaner and less expensive natural gas has hit the coal industry much harder than any kind of environmental regulation.
I think it's important, too, to remember, because it's very easy to say, well, he's fulfilling campaign promises, and he is. However, a majority of the people in this country did not sign on to those campaign promises. We are a deeply divided nation right now, and that's not to diminish the people who did want that, because clearly nearly half the country heard what he was saying, and they said, that's what we want. But you have another half of the country that didn't. And so we have a fight ahead of us. And I don't think it will benefit anyone to think that, well, you know, we should just roll over and accept all of this because that's what he promised. You still have the option every day to say, I support this, I don't support that. I've gotten more facts. I now think this would be too disruptive. And that goes for him as well. He did do it on NATO. Right. And,
correct.
You know, originally, he promised that he was going to pull us out of NATO. NAFTA. I'm sorry. It was the worst deal ever.
Right.
Was the way he described NAFTA. And yet, with sufficient pressure, you know, from people within his administration.
And maybe education.
And a little bit of education, maybe. And talking to the leaders of those other countries and coming to grips with the reality of, you know, what that agreement means to the United States and its economy. He has opted for, you know, what could be looked at as a fairly rational set of goals in this renegotiation.
Let's talk about another deeply divisive issue, birth control. We learned on Monday that President Trump is going to lift the mandate that companies have to offer birth control in their healthcare, or healthcare organizations have to offer it in their offering of a package of healthcare. Is this a done deal?
It certainly seems to be.
Okay.
I mean, you know, he has the authority to do that through executive order.
But the insurance companies then get the choice, correct? Or the employers get the choice?
The employers get the choice. Of course, the ones who would opt for this, you know, tend to be those with religious concerns. But it's not limited to, you know, Little Sisters of the Poor, which was the organization that first, you know, pushed this issue. I mean, it could extend to any corporation.
Hobby Lobby comes
to mind, yeah. And then you get to this idea of the corporations versus the individual, you know, which is what we went through with Citizens United and free speech, where corporations were given equal standing with individual citizens. And I fear this is another step on that road. Well, so if a corporation decides that they don't believe in health insurance at all, they could not provide that. What other religious issues are we going to acknowledge? And will it be all religions? Is it just Christian religion? Or will we observe the dictates of a Muslim-owned company that decides to impose strict separation of genders in the workplace? I mean, when you try to game this out, this is a really dangerous road we're going down. I think, you know, insurance, health insurance for your employers is not something where you can pick and choose and say, well, I support this element, but that, not that element. You either provide it or don't provide it.
I think it'll be quite compelling. We've talked about this from the climate change issue and the energy market issue, to see what happens if this does advance with corporations, because concurrently there are increasing areas of the country. Minnesota is fortunate to be one of them, that are beginning to have labor shortages. And the marketplace may ameliorate some of the impact of this, in the respect that they may feel, in order to attract the caliber and quantity of candidates that they need for certain jobs in certain industries, that they're going to continue, you know, to offer this. From a broader perspective, though, clearly this is going to be just the latest aspect of the healthcare debate that is highly political, and I believe is going to play a very significant role in the 2018 congressional elections.
Here's another element that I want people to think about. This is not a woman's issue. It's often framed that way. It is equally an issue to the men who get the women pregnant or might get them pregnant. It is for the woman who finds herself pregnant. There is no one who gets in this situation alone unless it's, you know, in vitro fertilization. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, you know, this is an issue for men and women alike who together have to plan for children, what to do if an unwanted pregnancy comes along. You know, birth control is the responsibility of both genders. And I don't think that can be said enough. This is not a woman's issue. This is a people issue.
You haven't chimed in since the president has been back from his overseas trip. And, you know, they're both sides of the aisle. He, of course, is touting it was a very successful trip. And often people thought he seemed presidential. He gave some good speeches. His Middle East speech was highly touted. His visit with Bibi Netanyahu seemed to have gone well. Then, of course, you have those terrible memes of him pushing the president of Montenegro out of the way. And there were some gaffes. What are your opinions of the trip? And did it go well for the United States?
I think we get a little too obsessed with the optics and the theatrics of it. You know, the orb picture, weird. Probably not
very
something
weird.
Anybody really wanted to happen.
But what was he going to do? Say no? Of course he had to do it.
You know, the sword dance. Yeah. You know, sure, he's not the first president to find himself in a weird situation like that.
Of course not.
However, the larger takeaway for me from that trip was that it continues to, you know, present this extraordinary affinity that he has for autocrats. And his seeming dislike or unwillingness to deal with the leaders of other democratically elected countries. So, you know, he was obviously having the time of his life with the Saudis. They feted him like a king. You know, who
his
wouldn't?
His face was up on
right.
sides
and,
of
you know,
buildings.
Come on, who wouldn't like that?
It's pretty nice.
But then he goes to Europe, our longtime allies, Germany, one of the most valuable alliances to come out of World War II was the U.S. alliance with Germany. And just, you know, the body language, the facial expressions, the things he said, everything made it clear that he was in no way as comfortable there as he was on the Middle East portion of the trip. A little odd, given everything, but it sort of reinforces those memes of autocrats versus democratically elected leaders, and I think that's something they really have to dispel.
When he spoke to Middle East leaders, distinctly from specifically Sunni nations, he said, quote, "I am not here to lecture," and that has traditionally been the role of American presidents from a bipartisan basis, is to, if not lecture, at least give the U.S. perspective on human rights and on freedom of the press and issues that are cherished by every American. And then he, of course, went to the NATO summit in Brussels, and he lectured and he hectored publicly about an issue that has legitimacy in that there are only 5 of 28 NATO nations that pay the targeted 2% of gross domestic product toward defense, and the U.S., of course, is one of them. This is an issue that, also on a bipartisan basis, something that was of concern to President Obama as an example, but President Obama worked it through in a much more diplomatic, quiet perspective and actually got some results because nearly every NATO nation has now pledged and has plans in place to get to that 2% by the year 2024.
Well, so, and I think that was true for George W. Bush as
well.
I mean,
yes.
He's also not the first president to be concerned about the lack of NATO contributions, but there are diplomatic ways to work through that that don't destroy alliances and humiliate, you know, world leaders.
And he did it, you know, at the new NATO headquarters in front of a new sculpture that was made of mangled steel from the World Trade Center. And, you know, that might have been a moment for him to much more specifically, number one, enunciate his support for Article 5, the common defense provision, and also acknowledge that the only time that Article 5 has ever been invoked has been actually by the United States after the 9/11 attack, where NATO came to the defense of the U.S. in its war in Afghanistan. So, you know, I think that while it's a military alliance, diplomacy matters, and that was a missed opportunity by President Trump.
One more national story, this Jared Kushner mess. Do you think it's time for Jared to opt out and be done?
Yeah, the time for that was, you know, long ago. I think he's more of a liability than an asset at this point. You know, his to-do list is ridiculously overburdened. He seems
peace
to be
in the Middle East, right? That was just one.
Right. Well, and now the whole communication mm-hmm. strategy. I mean, there is no problem that mm-hmm. he has not brought in on. You know, we did not elect a family to the presidency. We elected one man, and there are reasons that we have these, you know, constraints against nepotism, because now there are people that are starting to call this the United American Emirates. We're not, you know, we're not run by the Saudi family. We're run by, you know, professionals and duly elected representatives that have to observe all the normal rules that provide at least some measure of transparency in a democracy. None of that is happening right now, and I don't think it's serving him or his administration very well. He needs to broaden the number of people that he has some trust in.
If he does indeed leave because he feels that he can no longer serve in this capacity, or if there is more, you know, to this issue of him trying to set up a back channel with the Russians, it'll be extraordinary in many aspects. But also, he has served to some degree as a counterweight to Stephen Bannon, as an example, and those that are within the West Wing who want to pull President Trump on a much more nationalistic, populist rightward trajectory. And in general, Jared Kushner, as well as his wife and President Trump's daughter Ivanka and some others, have tried to pull them a little bit more towards traditional mainstream Republican policies. And so, you know, the impact would be significant in so many ways.
Except that we don't really know that, do we, John? I mean, we only know this through... We never hear from Jared Kushner.
No, I don't think we've ever heard him speak.
Right. I don't know
what it's
certainly
every
not
every
in a public setting.
This.
So
yeah.
This is all hearsay, you know, this notion that he acts as some kind of, you know, ameliorating influence on the evil Steve Bannon. I don't frankly know what his agenda is, what level of influence he has. You know, all of this plays out in secret, behind closed doors. It's a completely unknown quantity.
One last local story before I let you go, and thanks for letting me take up so much of your time. The big talker of the week has been the scaffold art project at mm-hmm. the Walker Art Center and the Sculpture Gardens. Now, I realize, and John mentioned even this before the podcast, you know, this might be more of a cultural subject matter, but it probably has political ramifications.
No, everything does.
There is a meeting this afternoon with the Walker, with mm-hmm. the artist, and elders of the Dakota tribe. What do you think should happen? What effect will this have on the Walker?
I don't think we should ever be in a position where, you know, art is the, that you have to have permission for art. You know, because sometimes art has the obligation to challenge, you know, maybe even to offend, but there is a way to do it. And not having even talked to the Indian American community, that's such a tin ear. It's really hard for me to believe that it didn't occur to anyone that an event that happened right here, right in this state, mm-hmm. You know, and we have descendants of the people that were hung at that platform, to not even say, you know, come talk to us. We want to do this project. What's the best way to do it? What's the best way to incorporate, you know, the Native American perspective on this? You know, is the sculpture garden even the appropriate place? Should it be someplace more solemn, more enclosed, where mm-hmm. you could have your own, you know, experience without being next to, you know, a blue chicken and a spoon and a cherry, which seems kind of odd to me, choice. But none of those things happen. So, yeah, I do think they have to rethink it.
I think it's important to acknowledge that some art is meant to offend very specifically. And this was meant, in effect, you know, as a commentary, not to offend, but against capital punishment and against, you know, the way that people had been treated historically in this country. But context is key, as is communication, and on both accounts, even the director of the Walker, you know, realizes that that did not proceed in the way that would have been ideal here. So, you know, we're taping this in midday here. I know they're looking to have an update, and my sense is that they probably will indeed remove this part of the sculpture garden here. And in fact, they had pushed back the planned Friday opening of this now to June 10th. So I think that's reflective of the direction that this is going.
There's something else that's important here that I think, you know, needs to be talked about. And that is, you know, no one is saying that this was, you know, that there was any sort of racist intent or, you know, anything like that in this installation. But there is sort of a betrayal of this dominant culture mentality where they think that they can anticipate what a minority culture is going to, how they're going to react to this. And instead of going and finding out, they just presumed, well, we're doing this for all the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that may be, but I think we have definitely entered a period in this country where, you know, minorities, you know, ethnic groups, minority cultures are pushing back and saying, you shouldn't assume. You should ask us. We should be part of this. We should be included in it. And that, to me, is the biggest lesson to take away from this.
This is a good education in how to talk to each other, how mm-hmm. to respect each other, and how to move forward, maybe with caution when
right.
we are unclear
yeah.
if somebody is going
even
to be
even if
hurt.
You think you have the best of intentions.
Exactly. John Rash and Patricia Lopez from the Star Tribune editorial board, wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for letting me eat up so much of your afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We will talk next week.
Thank you.